Now, ladies and gentlemen, the National Broadcasting Company brings you the latest news at home and abroad. The NBC Newsroom now presents on-the-spot reports from three of the major news centers in Europe, London, Bern, Switzerland, and Moscow. For our first report, we take you now to the British capital. Go ahead, London.
This is London. Fred Bates speaking. German raiding over this country last night was again small scale. There were bombs at points in southwest England and South Wales, with some damage and a few casualties. The Finnish note to this country is still under consideration and will not be published yet. There's no confirmation that the text is that broadcast from Holland recently. It's denied here that a joint Anglo-Russian protest has been sent to Turkey over her general attitude and particularly her position in her trade negotiations with Germany. United Press reports from Ankara this morning that an agreement for supplies of Turkish chrome to Germany is in the cards. The report adds, however, that these supplies may be a matter of the future. Turkey is standing by her agreement, which gives Britain a monopoly in this product until January 1943. Dr. Clodius, the German negotiator, is said to have demanded the delivery of half of the Turkish output, 850,000 tons of chrome, in 1943 and four, or he'd call off the negotiations. Turkey's said to have countered by asking Germany first to deliver armament orders placed long ago. Then she'll agree to deliver a maximum of 100,000 tons of chrome in 33 and four. In exchange for armament of the same value. Now it's up to Germany. Colonel Moore Brabazon, the Minister of Aircraft Production, was asked in the House about an all planes for Russia week. The minister said that industry itself had suggested this, but he decided not to adopt the suggestion because it would be misleading to suggest that the total airplane production in this country in any one week could be earmarked for Russia. It would obviously include types of aircraft which would not be of use to Russia. A good many people feel that the House of Commons gave up pretty valuable time yesterday in that debate about the exemption from military service of certain members of the Oxford Group movement. The Manchester Guardian remarks this morning that Britain is a luxurious country, or it could not have permitted itself the distraction at this critical stage of that controversy about the 11 lay evangelists of the Oxford Group. The editorial considers that the degree of emotion and what Mr. Bevin called high-pressure organization that this question has brought to the surface have been excessive and largely irrelevant. The point to be decided, says the editorial, is simpler than all that. It is merely whether, under the National Service Acts, the Oxford Group is entitled to be treated as a distinctly religious body. It says that, such as the Church of England or the Methodist Church, or to be treated as a social religious organization like the YMCA. They share the view of the government as stated by Ernest Bevin, the Minister of Labor. He did not regard the lay evangelists of the Oxford Group as engaged in religious work analogous to that of a religious denomination. The YMCA and similar organizations are also held to be outside regularly established denominations for purposes of military service at any rate. And they've accepted the ruling as Mr. Bevin feels the Oxford Group should accept it. At one time, only during the debate, did he let himself go. It was to rebuke the group between Buckman and Britain. We return you now to New York.
Now for the news at home, Earl Godwin in the NBC Newsroom in Washington.
Well, good morning, folks. It just happens to be a bit of information that I know following that London story that a great many of the Oxford Group friends here in Washington and in the United States are much disturbed at the news abroad, and they are working very hard today to get an expression of opinion from American leaders, particularly folks in Congress, that will help the Oxford Group and the Buckmanites in this country and possibly in London. And aside from that, I know very little about it. One of the most unusual bits of information I've gathered for some time past is the fact that many contractors on big government jobs have been startled by the size of their profits, and in view of the current wild outcries in Congress against big profits, offer to renegotiate their contracts. Incidentally, the CIO and other labor groups are using big profits to bolster their demands for big wages. But in the House, Chairman Vinson of the House Naval Affairs Committee made this plain yesterday and again last night personally after he had told the House yesterday of one contractor cutting a 247% melon on one job alone for the Navy. Vinson, who is by no means a business-baiting radical but chairman of the House Naval Affairs Committee and an old-time Southern Democrat with a conservative slant, 25 or 30 years' experience in Congress, threatens to start legislation reducing naval contracts and possibly all defense contracts to a flat 7% profit. This is newsworthy because Vinson is a leader likely to get such a limitation through on the next naval bill or whenever he tries for it. He knows because his committee started examining all contracts, started making this examination at the direction of the House of Representatives of itself. They've examined several thousand business contracts with the government. He reported to the House yesterday, pardon me, but the House directed Vinson to find out whether the armament program is being conducted expeditiously and economically. And he reported to the House yesterday, I'll quote him for a brief sentence, in certain instances, profits have reached an unconscionable percentage. Remember, Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau would start cutting them down after 6%, Vinson at 7, and Gore of Tennessee, who's pushing that complete 100% price-fixing bill, including wages, would take it all after 8%. Oil Coordinator Ickes follows James Moffat's statement last Friday that the British want to return some oil tankers. Moffat believed these tankers could be used to relieve a gasoline shortage, which Moffat says doesn't exist, but which Oil Coordinator Ickes says is very real. And Ickes yesterday announced the British want to return to us 15 tankers. But if they are returned, what do you think? They will be used to ship molasses and not gasoline, because molasses is used in the manufacture of alcohol. The president goes back at the seemingly difficult task of charting a way through Congress for repeal or modification of that neutrality law today, and he has bringing some new members of Congress up to see him. There's a difference among some of them. The question is whether to ask Congress to put guns on merchant ships and later ask for combat zone modifications or try to make a grand slam and wipe out all restrictions now. And that's all from Washington at this time.
Our next report comes to us from neutral Switzerland, central news filter in Western Europe. Go ahead, Bern.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles von Effenberg. The eyes of millions of people on this continent are turned toward the east today, where the Red Armies are fighting desperately to stem the giant German offensive. Judging from reports reaching this capital, fighting in the center is gaining in intensity. Although the Germans unleashed their fighting machine against the two extremities of the front, the northern and southern wings, when the big push started, late Russian reports tell of particularly heavy fighting around Bryansk in the middle front area. This report indicates that another great battle is developing in that section. Although the Germans have little to say on the matter, the Reds claim that the German losses at all points are very heavy, and at whatever ground the invaders are gaining, they are paying for with blood and machines. However, the Russians themselves admit that a general military situation is confusing on all parts of the front. And for that reason, it's impossible for them to give any accurate picture of the strategic or tactical positions of the opposing armies. Still, it's entirely possible that the heaviest fighting may shift from the wings to the center. Here, according to Russian comment, the Red Forces are in pretty good shape with regard to men and material. Since it's been the avowed intention of the Germans to destroy the Russian armies rather than drive through to objectives, it's likely that the Germans may smash into Timoshenko's armies while at the same time driving on in Moscow from the north and the south. There's no doubt that the Germans feel they must reach Moscow before the cold, bitter Russian winter sets in. And in that case, they'll have to hurry the job along. The first snowstorm of the year broke in the region of Moscow yesterday. The storm is described as heavy. In Berlin, the possibility of having to fight a winter campaign in a hostile country, where German lines of communication are long and hazardous, isn't viewed as a pleasant prospect. Officially, the Germans have ignored suggestions that such a winter campaign may be necessary. They have taken the attitude that the Russian armies will be broken and defeated before the really harsh weather sets in. Nevertheless, unofficial quarters are not so sure and admit that a winter in the vast Russian territory is certainly not going to do their armies any good. They view the prospect with concern and frankly confess that a Russian winter won't be an easy thing for their soldiers to put up with. Even as long as a month and a half ago, the call went out in Berlin for heavy winter shoes, the type skiers use. The explanation was that the shoes worn in the traditional German army boots were to be used by the German army of occupation. But the attitude of most Germans was, well, it looks like we're in for a long, musky winter. The Germans are keeping quiet about operations in the middle, but continue to release reports of successes in the south and the Leningrad section. On their side, the Reds tell of havoc caused among German columns by Soviet air units operating in the Leningrad section. In one raid, the Red pilots are said to have swooped down on a German motorized unit, wrecking 51 vehicles and putting 15 anti-aircraft batteries and one piece of heavy artillery out of commission. This wasn't done without opposition from the German Luftwaffe, but apparently the Red Flyers flew rings around the German pilots. Anyway, they say they shot down 7 Messerschmitts, but failed to report any losses to themselves. The defenders of death in the south are doing well, according to report here today. The Reds announced that 4 Romanian infantry battalions and the 175th Infantry Division of the 27th German Army have been scattered by a fierce Soviet attack. The Russian report heavy enemy losses and the capture of 49 big guns, trench mortars, and other equipment. Another Red claim is that the German advance in the Crimea is practically at a standstill, and that the fierce resistance of the Russians has forced the invaders to ease their pressure in that area.
We've heard Charles Lanius from Bern, Switzerland, and now another NBC correspondent is standing by in the capital of the Soviet Union, waiting to bring us latest news of the war. Go ahead, Moscow.
Soviet line of defense and their new drive aimed at the Russian capital. But they are paying a heavy price for every step forward. Hundreds of crippled Reichswehr tanks, armored cars, and trucks are stranded on the roads and fields, leaving to Vyazma and Bryansk, where the heaviest fighting is taking place, and hundreds of German corpses are strewn over the battlefields. Tymoshenko's resistance is not passive. It is dynamic, confident, hard-driving. Powerful counterattacks have been launched by him in at least 2 sectors of the gigantic battle, with the fighting in these sectors continuing in ever-mounting fury. Whenever the Germans meet resolute, well-prepared resistance, they retreat and drive in a new direction, hoping to find a weaker opponent there. They have succeeded in several points, but in the 2 sectors I have mentioned, the Russians just won't let them go, forcing them to accept their challenge, and have reported the destruction of 133 tanks in one sector and 65 in the other, in addition to crippled armored cars, trucks, field guns, and thousands of casualties among the blonde invaders. While Tymoshenko's forces are engaged in a life and death struggle with the most powerful armored fist in the history of all wars, Red Army counterattacks in most of the other sectors are gradually growing in scope and intensity, judging by dispatches reaching Moscow. On the Northwestern Front, an 18-day battle resulted in the loss of 4,000 Germans and Finns. In the gigantic battle for Leningrad, Voroshilov's men have recaptured a strategically important settlement on the approaches to Russia's second city and are pursuing the retreating enemy. Down in the south, a large-scale battle on the southern front for the point the Russians chose to call by the initial P for Peter is reported to have resulted in a complete halt of the enemy, who is suffering heavy, heartfelt losses. While the defenders of Odessa have routed 2 more recently reinforced Romanian infantry division with the aid of an effective landing behind enemy lines of Black Sea sailors. Still, the situation in the central sector is grave, and the Russians are the last to deny it. The Red Star has spoken plainly to the Red Army in its today's editorial. Quote, "Terrified at the prospect of a drawn-out war and the coming Russian winter, the Germans are trying to break through with..."
And now we're back in the NBC newsroom in New York, and that's the latest news. Now, this morning we heard from Fred Bate in London, Earl Godwin in Washington, Charles Lanius in Bern, Switzerland, and Robert Magadoff in Moscow. Keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.